supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Next time you go to the emergency room or a doctor's appointment in the Philadelphia area, you might get the sense that you're being watched. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Like so many other parts of our lives, even visits to healthcare spaces are now increasingly becoming a data point tracked by advertisers. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, personal injury law firms in particular see opportunity in this information that some privacy experts say should be confidential.
Advertisements that pop up on your phone that feel a little creepy. You've had the experience before. Say you're adjusting the toothpaste aisle of a grocery store, and all of a sudden, ads for Colgate are flashing on your Facebook feed. How the advertiser knew you were in that specific place, the toothpaste aisle, is often tied to technology called geofencing, a digital perimeter around a specific location. When you cross it, ads start popping up on websites you go to on your phone. The advertisers know your location by grabbing your phone ID from Wi-Fi, cell data, or an app using GPS. Retailers have been using this for years. But now, personal injury law firms want a piece of the action.
It's really the closest thing I think that an attorney could do to putting a digital kiosk inside of an emergency room.
That's Bill Kakis. He's a Long Island-based digital marketer who recently made deals with personal injury law firms in the Philadelphia area to send potential patients sitting in ERs targeted ads.
Is everybody in an emergency room going to need an attorney? Absolutely not. But people that are going to need a personal injury attorney are more than likely at some point going to end up in an emergency room.
Instead of giving you a coupon for Colgate's best teeth whitening toothpaste, you might now get the type of ad we're used to seeing on subways and on television. Have you been hurt? Here's a personal injury lawyer who can help. To Kakis, this is just modern-day target marketing. In his pitch to potential clients, he calls the technology, quote, totally legit. But Attorney General of Massachusetts Maura Healey doesn't think so.
Private medical information should not be exploited in this way, especially when it's gathered secretly without a consumer's knowledge, without knowledge or consent.
Healey's office was the first in the country to crack down on geofencing technology in healthcare spaces. Prosecutors there reached a deal with a Massachusetts-based digital advertising firm that was sending people who entered Planned Parenthood clinics advertisements from a Christian pregnancy counseling and adoption agency. When patients would go into the clinics, they'd also cross a digital fence and soon get advertisements that read things like, "You have choices," and "Click here for pregnancy help." Healey's deal banned the digital firm from Massachusetts. Prosecutors in Pennsylvania wouldn't say whether they're looking into the rise of similar tactics in the Philly area, but Healey says directing ads at people for seeking medical care is really a kind of digital harassment.
We just want to make sure that companies aren't exploiting information in violation of existing privacy laws with respect to health information that's so sensitive.
Most consumers realize that their phones are basically a tracking device, says Bill McGivern. He teaches internet and technology law at the University of Minnesota. McGivern says it's one thing to feel targeted in a grocery store, but it feels far more intrusive when it creeps into other parts of daily life.
Information about health, sexuality, finances, political views, people feel really differently about than they do about the brand of toothpaste they prefer.
Maybe a little creepy, but is it illegal? McGivern says not necessarily, at least not right now. The health privacy law known as HIPAA, for instance, would not apply to these location-based mobile ads.
It applies to hospitals and clinics and doctors and insurance companies, not to the lawyers and the marketers working on their behalf.
He says the Federal Trade Commission could crack down if information is being shared in a sneaky way. The FTC once went after a flashlight app that was deceptively sharing consumers' location with advertisers. But the feds have been slow to combat phone tracking in hospitals. Kakis, the advertiser, didn't want to reveal which personal injury law firms have signed on and which hospitals are affected. But he says the geo-targeted healthcare space campaigns are one of the fastest growing parts of his business.
Within a few weeks, we pretty much had every hospital taken up in downstate New York area.
Once you go to the other side of the digital fence, Kakis says the ads can show up for more than a month. Talking to people coming in and out of emergency rooms, one thing is clear. Some think these kinds of targeted ads are preying on people when they are the most vulnerable. Take Joe Finnegan. He was recently leaving a hospital in Center City and he stopped to chat. He said he does not want his trip shared with anyone.
It's supposed to be your privacy as a patient.
Finnegan says seeing law firm ads tied to his recent hospital visit would make him feel outraged, since he had no idea he was crossing into the geo-targeted zone.
I mean, you couldn't put a physical fence up. Why would you be able to put a cyber fence up? I don't get it.
Meanwhile, Kakis, in his initial talks with law firms looking for clients, he says he's used this pitch before. What's your target demographic for injured people? Well, there isn't one, because everybody gets injured. But the ads that go along with that pitch make Finnegan wonder,
if they're tracking your every move in that regard, what else are they watching?
Sometimes it just depends which side of the fence you're on. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
On this 64th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling striking down separate but equal schools, a civil rights coalition today filed a lawsuit claiming racial segregation persists in New Jersey schools. Joining me with a closer look is Colleen O'Day with NJ Spotlight. Colleen, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be here.
What's the gist of the suit?
It says exactly what you let in with, which is that New Jersey's schools are segregated. And the reason they're segregated is because New Jersey state law essentially requires a child to go to public school in the town where he lives. And New Jersey's towns are among the most segregated. The state as a whole is among the most segregated in the nation. About 20% of the towns in New Jersey are at least 90% white. And then, the reverse is true. We've got a lot of very high black and or Hispanic communities. So when you're living in a community that is segregated, your schools are naturally going to be segregated. So this suit is asking that provision of state law that requires students to go to school in the district where they live to strike that down, and instead to come up with some other unique ways to send students to schools.
So if the root issue is that we're dealing with residentially segregated municipalities, what are some of those unique opportunities to redress the problem?
The idea is to make some attractive alternative kinds of schools, not to force folks into schools maybe that they don't want to attend, but that will attract students to go to cross boundary lines. Former Chief Justice Gary Stein, who is heading up this effort for the New Jersey Coalition for Diverse and Inclusive Schools, was talking a lot about Hartford, Connecticut, where they had a lawsuit, and they have instituted a whole bunch of magnet schools that you get a general education, but each also has a specialty with it, be it a music school or a science school, those kinds of things. And what happens up in Hartford is that these schools are located either in the city or in the suburbs surrounding it, and students can go to any of the schools, not the school that is in their town necessarily. And according to Justice Stein, that has resulted in a great increase in diversity among the schools.
Now, this does pertain to public education, and charter schools in New Jersey are found to be culpable as well.
In fact, charter schools might possibly be even more segregated than the average school. And that's because the charter schools have tended to be located in the cities which are residentially segregated and where the schools are segregated, because you have large populations of African Americans and Hispanics. The suit is especially critical about the charter schools because it includes language that was in the charter school law that says the State Commissioner of Education should have been all along looking at the question of segregation and trying to police that. And if a school is too segregated, perhaps not renewing its charter. According to the lawsuit, that's never happened in the state.
Colleen, the complaint filed today claims that the state and New Jersey's Department of Education has been aware of the pervasiveness of the problem for nearly half a century. What chance is there that this suit might affect real change?
When you read the suit, it certainly sounds like they've made their case. New Jersey collects data on race and ethnicity of students, and so it would kind of be hard to argue that they don't know that there are large concentrations of students of certain races in certain districts and almost all white in other districts. We also had a very interesting comment today from the Murphy administration, which might indicate that they might be willing, rather than to fight this in court, perhaps to come up with some sort of a settlement. Essentially, in the statement, it says that the governor believes in combating segregation, and he is committed to boosting diversity in schools. So if that were to happen, there might be some change fairly quickly. If not, and it does go to the Supreme Court, we're looking at many, many years.
Thanks, Colleen.
Thank you, Dave.
Colleen O'Day with NJ Spotlight. Today was graduation day at the Rutgers University Law School in Camden. The keynote speaker was a figure from recent U.S. history, a woman who was raising the alarm about sexual harassment long before the Me Too movement. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Law professor and activist Anita Hill became a household name in the early 1990s when she testified before Congress about allegedly being sexually harassed by then U.S. Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. Thomas was confirmed by the Senate and still sits on the court today. At the time, Hill faced intense criticism and pressure for speaking out. But now, she says, society is changing, and she told the Rutgers Camden law graduates it'll be up to their generation to make sure that change continues.
What happens now? I would say we will never be the same after the Me Too movement, after such revelations of sexual violence. We can never, as a society, ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. We can't be the same as we were before. And we certainly
Hill's message resonated with many of the Rutgers students, especially those already hoping to use their degrees for social justice, students like Shahida Williams.
Do you have a plan for what you're going to do with this degree, or what are you thinking?
I'm going to change the world.
The Detroit native is the first in her family to become a lawyer. She wants to run for office and become a senator one day, and she said Hill's speech encouraged her to use her legal skills for good.
So I thought it was a tremendous call to action to not just make money, but to engage in social justice.
Hill asks students to promise her that they'll be committed to equality not just today, graduation day, but for the rest of their lives as well. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The Gershman Y has occupied the building at Broad and Pine Streets in Philadelphia for 94 years, back when it was called the Young Men's Hebrew Association. Now, it's moving out of the building and changing its name. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that as the newly renamed Gershman Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival, it will focus solely on movies.
The change is immediate. Before today, the Gershman Y had offered many cultural opportunities, including visual arts, music, lunchtime history lectures, klezmer dance lessons, and the popular Latke Palooza, a Hanukkah Latke Bake-Off contest. Board Chair Jacob Cohen says the most popular offering has been the annual Jewish Film Festival.
In our opinion, we were doing really wonderful programming and other, you know, visual arts and, you know, some music events. We felt that the film programming was unique in what we were doing and that we presented that on a higher level. There's a ton of supporters and a lot of people came to see the films.
The Gershman Y is going to double down on its film programming by cutting away all other cultural offerings and rebranding itself as the Gershman Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival with year-round screenings of international films. There are a lot of other Jewish organizations in the city with a range of cultural offerings, and Cohen says the longevity of the Gershman depends on focusing its resources more narrowly.
You know, our goal is to sustain the organization long-term and really to be able to serve the community and the city of Philadelphia forever. This is the best way to continue to have a long life and continue to serve the Jewish community of Philadelphia.
Cohen says the organization has not yet found its new home. The Young Men's Hebrew Association building at Broad and Pine has been owned by the University of the Arts since 2000, and the Gershman's lease is up. Cohen does not yet know if the new home, wherever it is, will have space for public events or just office space for coordinating film screenings. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Richard Trey Jenkins recently got the email of his life, an acceptance letter from Harvard University. Despite facing several challenges, the Philadelphia senior's perseverance and hard work earned him a full ride to the Ivy League school. Keystone Crossroads reporter Annette John Hall first met Jenkins 4 years ago when she was program director at Mighty Writers, a nonprofit after-school program. The two recently reunited in the group's West Philadelphia studio to catch up and celebrate Trey's achievement.
How did you feel about being here at Mighty Writers? And what do you think Mighty Writers helped you with?
Mighty Writers felt like a home for me. I was actually upset that Mighty Writers didn't happen on Friday afternoons. So I'm like, okay, well, what am I going to do on Fridays? Because I was always excited to come here, excited to start writing.
I knew when you came through these doors and I asked you to submit a writing sample. And what did you submit? Do you remember?
I think it might have been an excerpt from one of my stories I was writing at the time.
It was a book, Trey.
Oh.
It was a book. It was a book. It was a science fiction book, some sort of science fiction manuscript. Do you remember that?
I remember, because I had been writing that from sixth grade. So, yeah.
It was around then when Trey's family, his mother and younger brother, found itself homeless. They were living in a shelter in Philadelphia. Trey sometimes felt ashamed and would even lie about it to classmates. But he says the experience made him stronger.
One time I was walking back from school with my friend Joshua, and we're on the corner, literally next to the shelter that I lived at the time. And it looked like a big house. It looked like it could have been a mansion. So I just told him, yeah, that's my house right there. Because I was so embarrassed to say I lived in a shelter. And after that conversation, after he turned off and went back to his house and I went into the shelter, I started thinking, yo, I really shouldn't have lied about that. I felt horrible about it. And so eventually I went and told him. But that's when I realized I got to buckle in, because I can't have any of my potential kids going through what I'm going through now. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't a situation that I felt like was acceptable.
Even though the family was on hard times, Trey's mom, Kiana Hamilton, was a fierce advocate for his education. She researched all of the options and was ultimately able to get him into a college prep school for disadvantaged kids in North Philly. Trey excelled through school and then applied to some big-name universities.
I checked Penn, and I got waitlisted. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, at least it's not a denial. I checked Yale, and I got denied. I'm like, okay. In my head, I'm already thinking, okay, Harvard's going to deny me too. I got to think about where I'm going to go to school. And I open up the Harvard tab, and there's a link to a video saying, welcome to the class of 2022. That's basically how it was.
I am so very, very proud of you. When your mother, when Miss Kiana told me that you had been accepted into Harvard, I started tearing up. I was, it's true, Trey, because how often does that happen? I mean, how often does that happen with students from Philly?
Right.
You know, African-American students from Philly. I mean, I told Miss Kiana it was like you had hit the life lotto.
Basically.
What advice, Trey, would you give to kids who come from the same place you come from? You know, kids who may be listening to this right now and thinking, wow, well, you know, he struck it lucky. But I know that's not going to happen to me.
As advice, I would say just stay focused. Because if there's anything that can get you where you want to go, it's being focused on the right track. And the right track could be different for a lot of people. But it's basically just whatever you want to be, work toward that. Everything you do needs to be focused on that.
That was Keystone Crossroads reporter Annette John Hall speaking with Richard Trey Jenkins, who just got into Harvard University. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Vinyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.